I'm Redbeard, with the stories behind history's greatest rock and roll albums. Today, in the studio, it's the unlikely saga of the South Texas musical prodigy who took his one-in-a-million chance all the way to number one.
To have gone calculating to really like put together the All-American band and all of that, and then to have that song, A Marriage, as the one, the totally uncalculated song that almost didn't make it, it actually was a sort of a vindication to me in that sometimes no matter how much you may try, sometimes it's the thing that you just most naturally do that comes from the heart is the thing that works.
Those kind of sounds had not been heard on a radio before. And when that final little filter sweep and oscillation came down on the radio, everyone had to crank it up and listen to that because it was a new sound.
Hi, this is Edgar Winter in the studio for They Only Come Out at Night.
There certainly have been plenty of musicians who started out playing straight-ahead, no-frills rock and roll, and then grew more adventuresome in their musical explorations as they matured. The Beatles, for instance, went from the simplicity of Love Me Do to the complexities of, say, Strawberry Fields in the short space of 3 years. And Frank Zappa, best known for his novelty songs, was actually a brilliant jazz composer and orchestrator. But it's extremely rare, practically unheard of, to find an accomplished jazz or classical musician who switches over to rock and roll. However, that's exactly what happened to Texas multi-instrumentalist singer-songwriter Edgar Winter. By this time in 1973, the Edgar Winter Group had the number 3 album in the country, and a month later, the number 1 song. But the top of the Billboard charts is a million miles away from the tough Texas refinery town of Beaumont, where Edgar Winter and his older brother Johnny, both albinos with snow-white hair and legally blind, grew up in the 1950s and 60s.
I was aware of being different at a very early age. When I first went to kindergarten, I knew that I was different. I didn't see any other kids around with white hair other than Johnny. I knew that I couldn't see as well. But in terms of that actually affecting my music, it's difficult for me to say because, I think that we all are unique and we all have things that motivate us and we have our share of problems and difficulties, whether or not they are necessarily so visible. And overcoming those, learning to accept them, that's just part of living. The first club we played at was a place called Tom's Fish Camp. I was 11 at the time, and Johnny was must have been 14 then. This older couple, Tom and Tiny, owned the place. Looking back on it, it was just an old place, sawdust floor, jukebox. People would come, drink beer and dance, and it was amazing to me. I said, wow, here we are in a nightclub and people dancing and we're playing the music. They watched after us and took care that nothing would happen because we were young kids and they could, I think they paid us like $8 a man a night or something. If they had gotten grown-up musicians, they would have had to have paid them a lot more. So was a good deal for them and good experience for us at the same time.
Tobacco Road,
The standard Tobacco Road from Edgar Winter's 1970 debut album entitled Entrance certainly could have been the address of that Beaumont Roadhouse Tom's Fish Camp where Edgar Winter and his big brother Johnny played as kids. In 1969, when another youngster named Stevie Vaughan was still in middle school in Dallas, the hot Texas blues rock guitarist that was all the rage was Johnny Winter. Younger brother Edgar had played a number of musical instruments in Johnny's backing band.
Johnny had emerged as a guitar player, and consequently, I found myself playing just about everything else. I did play guitar initially, but when he really got seriously interested in it, I picked up the piano. And then later I played drums with him, and I played bass. At the age of about 15, I became interested in jazz and saxophone. Cannonball Adderley, John Coltrane. It was just about at that point when I became more interested in jazz, when the parting of the ways came for Johnny and myself. He at that time said, well, I don't think I want no saxophone player in my band. So I said, okay, I'll get my own band.
You know, I've heard it said there's beauty in distortion by some people who withdraw to find their head. Now they say that there is humor in misfortune. No, I wonder if they'll laugh when I am dead. Why am I fighting to live if I'm just living to fight? Why am I trying to see when there ain't nothing in sight? Why am I trying to give when no one gives me a try? Why am I dying to live if I'm just living to die? They're just speaking words that someone else has said. And so they live and fight and kill with no objective. Sometimes it's hard to tell the living from the dead. Why am I fighting to live if I'm just living to fight? Why am I trying to see when there ain't nothing in sight? Why am I trying to give when no one gives me a try? Why am I dying to live if I'm just living to die? So I'll keep fighting to live till there's no reason to fight. And I'll keep trying to see until the end is in sight. You know I'm trying to give, so come on, give me a try. You know I'm dying to live until I'm ready to die.
Edgar Winter's 1971 sophomore effort called Edgar Winter's White Trash, a genuine 4.5-star classic according to the All Music Guide, combining funk, blues, R&B, and rock and roll to create one of the freshest sounds of the early 70s, writes Michael B. Smith. Here's Edgar Winter.
Ever since I started out in music, I never felt that songs had to follow that formula of verse, chorus, verse, chorus, bridge. Course. My first album, for example, the Entrance album, was a total departure from that. It was more of a mixture, sort of a precursor of fusion music in that it integrated jazz and classical and rock. And one side was a continuous, like a 25-minute piece with seven movements. So I love rock and roll, and I'm really grounded in that blues, that very primitive blues tradition with gospel and having played with my brother Johnny for years. But I also liked a lot of the R&B and funk, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, and gospel. And I had a lot of those interests too in more sophisticated types of music.
The release of the live album Roadwork the following year revealed that Edgar Winter had emerged from the shadow of his big brother as a band leader and showman.
I was really going through a sort of a metamorphosis. When I originally started playing with Johnny, for example, I would walk out on the stage and I would just stand there and play. I didn't do anything theatrical, didn't really move around. My persona was just much like I just thought I was out there to play music. I was very shy. I didn't grant interviews. I felt like everything I had to say, I could say with my music. I was a very introverted person. Through White Trash, I got to be a lot more active until finally when I put together They Only Come Out at Night, you know, I was ready just to go for the jugular.
Don't you know that I was sitting back in Texas? Ha! I was playing old rhythm and blues. And then I got a big offer for more money than I could refuse. I had my chance to make it, playing anything I wanted to play. But playing back in my mind, you know I could hear the people say, you know that I've been doing lots of things. Well, I have been trying hard to figure it out. But there's a certain kind of music, yeah, got to make you jump and shout. Now you can call it commercial if you wanna see it that way. But playing back in my mind, you know I can hear the people say, keep playing that rock and roll.
I'm Redbeard, and coming up next, Edgar Winter will be joined by guitarist Ronnie Montrose in the studio for They Only Come Out at Night.
Welcome back to In the Studio for They Only Come Out at Night. This is Edgar Winter with Redbeard.
This million seller, which peaked at number 3.
After doing the entrance album was critically acclaimed, which is a euphemistic way of saying it didn't sell a great deal of records, but got real good reviews. And I still get, like, you know, shows a lot of people say, why don't you do more of, do songs from the entrance album, especially from musicians. It was more musicians, music. After that, I formed the band White Trash, and that once again was like R&B funk oriented gospel music. A lot of the people that I had played in high school with were in that band, and basically what we wanted to do was bring that that excitement. Like I had observed that I'd like been to a lot of the all black churches where they have like an organ player, organ, guitar, bass, and drums. And I mean, they just would create pandemonium. I mean, people would go crazy in those revivals. Like they would do those tent revivals. We would go to those and you know, be 4,000 or 5,000 black people there and like 2 or 3 of us. That was, I'll never forget those experiences. And to me, that's what Ray Charles did. He really translated that into a popular form of music. It was not, it took it out of church. And I think that all too often that whole gospel thing is overlooked. I mean, it's frequently you hear about the influence of blues, but that whole fire of gospel music, like you never heard shouting in music, and that's basically where that came from, was from church. And that was what White Trash was all about. And we did the White Trash album and Roadwork, which was a gold album. And after that band broke up, you know, I was discussing future direction with Steve, my manager. And this actually gets us into They Only Come Out at Night and what it really was. And I think it's somewhat necessary to go back into that ancient history to really understand how that album came about. The intention there was like to, I felt like all of those past albums were in a way they were specialized. They weren't really mass appeal kind of albums. It was like for a restricted audience. And what we wanted to do was to make an album for everybody. In other words, we wanted to organize the ultimate all-American, all-star rock and roll band. That was our outright intention. And so we did auditions all over. I think I went to Chicago and California and in New York looking for just the right people. And I really wanted to have, to borrow from Todd Rundgren, a sort of a utopian band in that everybody would contribute, not just as a player, but as a writer and to the overall direction of the band. And the first person I found was Dan Hartman, who was from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and he had sent a tape of songs to Blue Horizon. It was Blue Sky Management, I think, at that time. And I was real impressed with the tape and met Dan, and we played together and said, well, this is it. This is going to be the basis of the band, would be the collaboration of Dan and myself. I liked his style of being able to integrate pop, you know, as well as understanding those other. He wasn't really grounded in like technically as I was in jazz or classical music, but he could hear all of that. He had the natural ability, and though his interest didn't run that way, he was very sensitive to that. And I thought like he was like the perfect balance as a collaborative, as a writing partner. So then we found Ronnie Montrose in California, and we wanted like the ultimate flash rock and roll guitar player. So Ronnie seemed to fill the bill, and his friend Chuck Ruff became the drummer. Now, we originally used Johnny B, who played with Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. Great guy, great drummer. And the first songs that we went in to record before the actual band was completely settled upon and established, Johnny B played on Free Ride, and We All Had a Real Good Time on those two tracks. And we recorded those songs separately and first before the rest of the album, and that was before Chuck had joined the band. So that was me, Dan, Ronnie, and Chuck. We had two drummers for a while. Another one of the drummers, we had Rick Marotta played with us for a while. Really, basically, what I wanted to say was that was the thing that made They Only Come Out at Night different was the fact that rather than being for a specialized or more musical audience, it was an album for everybody.
Free Ride, which went to number 14 on the Billboard chart, from They Only Come Out at Night by the Edgar Winter Group. It was written and sung by a then-unknown musician, Dan Hartman, whom Edgar Winter had discovered. Another draftee that Edgar Winter found was a little-known San Francisco session guitarist named Ronnie Montrose.
I think the main thing that attracted people to the Edgar Winter group was the chemistry between me and Edgar. And the way that, on stage, the way that we related to each other, because I had a lot of fire and a lot of electricity, a lot of enthusiasm, and I think that we balanced out. Edgar's more of a, certainly a very cool, concentrated sort of a fellow, you know, very consistent, and the times that I can recall working with Edgar where we changed an arrangement, I can count on one hand, because I think Edgar's like a, with the way that we had set it up, just wanted it a certain way, and we played it that way every night. But there were times when we sort of cut loose a little bit. But I think that was the basic attraction.
Up next, Edgar Winter and Ronnie Montrose bring the monster hit Frankenstein back to life. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio for the Edgar Winter Group's They Only Come Out at Night.
Welcome back to In the Studio for They Only Come Out at Night. This is Edgar Winter with Redbeard. Rick, as you all probably know, was the leader of a band called the McCoys, who had the big hit Hang On Sloopy, and his name was then Rick Zeringer, which he changed the Z to a D to become Rick Derringer. And I met Rick. He was still playing with the McCoys, and he played with me, and he also played with Johnny. He played with Johnny and Johnny Winter and when they had two guitars, bass, and drums, and the bass player in that band was Randy Hobbs from the McCoys. And Rick's brother, Randy Z, played drums for a while. Then Bobby Caldwell replaced him. Also, Rick played and produced some in the White Trash Band. Played a couple of solos, although Floyd Radford was the original White Trash guitar player. So Rick played, he ended up playing in White Trash toward the end of that band, and the same thing in the Edgar Winter Group. After Ronnie Montrose left, Rick stepped in to play guitar. Now, Rick produced the album They Only Come Out at Night. I think the engineer, Bill Sinzik, also had a lot to do with that album. Bill, later, he went on to produce the Eagles, and he was right at that stage when he was graduating from being an engineer to a producer. And I think having him at the controls there really had a lot to do with the sound of that album, not to take anything away from Rick's production. But they were a good combination. My intention was to put together the type of band that that any one of the people could be could have his own band and you know would be talented enough and have the you know the writing ability as well as the, like the stage presence and charisma to be a leader. I mean, that's that was the whole idea. It was supposed to be an all-star band, which was why I went to such extraordinary lengths to, like, go over, the, you know, travel all over the country to find just the right people. And, you know, and some of it is luck, too. You know, it's hard to, to know, in some cases, there were two or three choices to be made, and I guess I made the right ones. I was very naive at the time in that I saw no reason why there could not be a band in which everybody could be a star and that we could all support one another in our solo efforts and all play on one another's albums, be supportive of our individual careers as well as have a group together. Now, it, I knew that that would be, I knew that that sounded good, but that it very seldom in real life works out that way, which is the case. But I don't think that we would have made the music that that we did had I approached it, you know, in any other way. Welcome back to In the Studio, where they only come out at night. This is Edgar Winter with Red Beard.
Thanks, Edgar. It's the anniversary of the Edgar Winter Group's number one song from that album. Only a handful of instrumentals have ever captured the American audience the same way. Telstar did it in the dawn of the space age. Paul Mauriat's Love is Blue did too a decade after that. But the Edgar Winter Group hit the number one slot in May 1973 with an instrumental with the unlikely title of Frankenstein. With the backstory, here's Edgar Winter.
Rick and Chuck Ruff still have a running riff about that. At one point, we were editing the song, and the original song is probably between 8 and 9 minutes long. The stage version of it is about 15 minutes long. And when we recorded the song in the studio, the original version was too long, obviously. It had a lot of extemporaneous solo work and, you know, stuff on it that did not make the record, which is why I was nervous about doing it at the time. I mean, it was really the one song that when we played it live that we really got to stretch out and solo a lot. So at one point, we were there and there were about, 20 pieces of tape lying all over the studio. And we were trying to edit it back together. And basically what we were having to do is like take out these phrases, like when a figure would go, we'd have to take out each second half of that so as to compress the whole thing into actually half the amount of time, but still have the melodic flow remain the same. So at some point, with all of these pieces lying on the floor and our trying to remember, now did this piece go there and when was that? And Chuck Roth made the comment, wow, it's like Frankenstein, drawing the analogy of, you know, putting the monster together, you know, an arm here and a leg there from different body pieces. He said evidently he was watching the tape, like watching all the edits go by, and made the comment about Frankenstein. And Rick apparently overheard it and picked up on the, hey, Frankenstein, that's not a bad title for the song. We'll call it Frankenstein. For me, I just thought the imagery was perfect. I mean, it has that, to me, that whole theme, it just sounds like Frankenstein. It has that awkward, lumbering kind of, you know, monster kind of feel. So regardless of who came up with it, as soon as I heard the suggestion, I thought, yeah, well, that's perfect. That's it.
A monster of a hit from They Only Come Out at Night by the Edgar Winter Group. Here's guitarist Ronnie Montrose.
Frankenstein was a fluke, but I think that it was, like I say, I think it was timely because it was certainly the cutting edge of synthesizer work. And because those kind of sounds had not been heard on a radio before, and when that final little filter sweep and oscillation came down on the radio, everyone had to crank it up and listen to that because it was a new sound.
Edgar Winter in the studio.
The reason I wanted it on is because I felt like everything else on the album was so commercial. It needed that for balance, you know, to have something more eclectic and something just to let people know that Edgar Winter was definitely still in there and that I hadn't sold out. There was a little piece of riff in Frankenstein that came from the Entrance album, which I thought was a nice little twist and musical comment. To have gone, you know, through all of that in terms of calculating to really like put together the All-American Band and all of that, and then to have that song, Emerge, as the one, the totally uncalculated song that almost didn't make it, it actually was a sort of a vindication to me in that sometimes no matter how much you may try to calculate and in terms of deciding like what you think people are going to like and what should be commercial, sometimes it's the thing that you just most naturally do that comes from the heart is the thing that works.
love that song from Edgar Winter Group's 1974 album, Shock Treatment, That's Easy Street. Edgar freely admits that coming to the commercial world of mainstream rock and roll from jazz did have its own learning curve.
Because I had this running riff with my manager, Steve, we were talking about, like, you know, what makes the huge, successful hit album. And I, because of my musical influences, when I would listen to music, a lot of it just seemed very, like, simplistic to me and so formalized. And I would say, well, you know, that's easy, you know. And he would say, well, why don't you do it? And, you know, the hard thing about that is to do it and to mean it, to come up with that kind of music, but to maintain your integrity at the same time. In other words, we went out to play, and we were bash, crash, rock and roll loud, but it was good. And I never felt at any time in that whole thing did I compromise the musical integrity of, you know, of what I was doing. I wanted to have that kind of band. My intention was just to create complete pandemonium on stage. That's what we set out to do. There was a conscious desire to put the focus more on the energy than on the music, in other words. So our whole thing was, let's go out there and rock. And that's what we did.
We was rolling in the grass out behind the bar.
This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking Edgar Winter and Ronnie Montrose. We'd like to dedicate today's edition to the late Dan Hartman, who passed away in 1994. In the studio was written this edition by yours truly, transcription by Jane Carpenter, theme song by Andy Timmons. In the studio was produced by Barbarossa Limited, copyright 2008, all rights reserved. Be a part of the In the Studio Network at inthestudio.net.